Rich, you're on mute.
I know what I'm doing, honestly. Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. The OMI in Bookomi stands for the original memorable insight, the OMI, that we find in books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology and culture.
Hello, I'm Will Greenwood.
And I'm Ben Fennell, and we're the authors of World Class.
And this is our OMI for Bookomi.
This week, we're sharing OMI with two brilliant minds, England Rugby World Cup champion, Sky broadcaster and club coach Will Greenwood, and his friend of 30 years, Ben Fennell, whose stellar career in advertising at BBH led to founding the Growth House in 2018, where he continues to work with massive brands such as Costa, Virgin Media and AstraZeneca. Together, Will and Ben have produced a book for leaders who want to blend their own personal development with the growth of the people around them.
Mental health, personal mental health each day and work on that to definitely practice your physical health on each and every day and make sure you get an element of teamship into every single 24 hours that you pack in. So physical health, mental health and teamship are sort of our three building blocks that both Ben and I really like to focus on.
In World Class, How to Lead, Learn and Grow Like a Champion, they celebrate and demonstrate the power of diverse minds, abilities and attitudes at work, as seen through the lens of hard-won experiences in sport and business. Will and Ben, welcome to Bookomi.
Hello there.
Will, if I could start with you, you're still connected to competitive rugby, but you've crossed over into the broadcasting and business world. What is it about the world of rugby, do you think, that prepares you for the business world as opposed to any other sport?
It's also a chicken and egg question there. The reality is I am old enough and played in black and white, almost sepia, that when I was at university, rugby was an amateur sport. So we trained on Monday and Thursday at Durham University. We played Wednesday, Saturday. Then I left Durham with an economics degree behind me and got a job at Midland Global Markets that became or was swamped by HSBC. And I was a foreign exchange trader and then worked on the life floor. So the reality is when I spent time on the life floor, which is an open outcry trading system, trading floor, trading platform, where I was involved with the Italian government bond, the BTP, and the shorter form interest rates, the Euro Lira, Euro Swissy, all these fantastic financial functions that were tradable. It was 3,000 people shouting and screaming with a funny colour jacket on, trying to prioritise, trying to work together in amongst chaos and carnage and noise and volume and unexpected situations taking place, that I genuinely say a World Cup final was a stroll in the park compared to a day on the life floor when Bundesbank, the German Bundesbank, cut rates unexpectedly. So I was very fortunate to reverse engineer that process that you took place. So I understood to a certain degree business, but chaos and prioritisation and communication, which allowed me to take the rugby field with understanding of how to bring teams and individuals together. Rich, you're on mute.
I know what I'm doing, honestly. Ben, what about you in the rough and tumble world of advertising? You joined BBH as a trainee and you stayed at the same company and rose through the ranks. But I would think that the games in an ad agency are more mind games, aren't they?
I think the wonderful thing about a career in advertising is you are exposed to tons of very different businesses. So, you know, you operate across a whole set of different categories. And obviously in the start of your career, you're literally making the ads, you're developing the communication. But if your career goes well, you're pretty quickly leading teams, you're part of a team. And then the bit that I loved the most, which was facing into senior clients. And I think one of the great delights of the career that I had was that the most senior people at Diageo, Unilever, Tesco, etc., cared about the communication, wanted to have a relationship with the agency. And so when you caught up with a Dave Lewis or a Carolyn McCall at ITV or an Alan Jope at Unilever, they would talk, of course, first about the communication because that was your job. But then you'd pretty quickly start talking about growth, how they were trying to grow their business, how they were trying to grow their team. but often, interestingly, how those kind of people were trying to grow themselves.
The book is in three parts. In the first part, Celebrating Difference, you talk about the importance of cognitive diversity in a team, how strength can be found by combining diverse talents to seek the same purpose. In sport, you can pick and choose who plays from game to game, and the outcome is clear to win. But in business, you're stuck with the same players and the goalposts are often moving. How should a business leader pick their team for the long term?
Difference, togetherness and growth, which is the equation, the sort of the mathematical formula that we're sort of putting forward. There are many sports where I think it's true, but if you follow the camera down a national anthem before a rugby match, you'll see it go down for the tiny quick guys and then up for these giants. I don't think there is a sport where there's so much physical difference, fast guys, strong guys, fit guys, etc. And we just thought of all the sports, it's the most brilliant metaphor for our core argument. Pack your team with difference. That is job one of the leader. And if you haven't got enough difference, you need to go out and find it. Difference of every sort, of course, of gender and ethnicity and background, but as you say, cognitive difference. And then once that is done, and that's never a job that's ever finished, you're always looking to update, tweak, evolve the team. Then you have to push to create the kind of togetherness that is needed to create a high performing team. And the two extremes are, of course, flawed. Tons of difference with no togetherness doesn't work. And tons of togetherness without enough difference doesn't work. You've got one view of the mountain. So that's the kind of the balance we believe in sport and in business the leader is always trying to find.
And without that togetherness and diversity, without the leader knowing how they work together, you get cliques, don't you, in tribes. And that's when things start to go wrong. Will, you've been a member of a very successful World Cup winning side, the England rugby team of 2003. What's the best and worst feedback you've ever received, a lot thinking around that winning formula or on the journey to that moment in 2003 and since? What's the best and worst feedback you've ever received personally, and how did it affect your game?
I mean, I think the reality is, without necessarily naming names and particular quotes, I think any feedback that lacks context, any feedback that focused on negatives, doesn't offer any solutions, doesn't allow you to come up with the right answers. Let me focus on the context one, though, that I think you need to understand the story behind the player, behind the individual. We love one great quote from Razor Robertson, who's the most successful coach in the Southern Hemisphere in terms of, I think, four consecutive Super Rugby titles with the Crusaders. And he says, get the heart, get the player. And that doesn't mean you ruin players and blow sunshine at backsides or blow trumpets when credit isn't due. But you work with players, you work alongside players, you commit radically to identifying areas that of work-ons that need improvement, but continue to allow the player to be the best version of themselves. And in all your communication, you're keeping that context right at the very heart of all your discussions.
Ben, you have to filter feedback, I suppose you're more directly working with leadership teams now, but in your role as the CEO at BBH, you and your account managing team, I assume account managing teams still existed up to a few years ago, but you would have to filter out feedback from a client to a creative team. Now, how is that different when you're filtering, when you're in a service industry? How is it different feeding feedback secondhand? How do you package it up?
I think especially
when it's tricky.
Yeah. So I think in my work with the Growth House, we spend more time talking about feedback and challenge than any other topic. I'm thrilled that's the first place you've gone to, because I think it is such a critical component of elite teams, the ability to disagree in a way that's challenging but positive, to focus your energy on the issue and not on the person. And so if you're working, as I did for a long time, in essentially an account man role, you are absolutely the filter between the client's feedback and the creatives. I would go first to the point that Will's just made, which is context. So, for example, if the creative person really understands what it is that the client's trying to do, if you've set that context, if it's really important that we've got to speak to women above a certain age, if we've really made that clear to them and we've set that context, or they've had a really terrible experience with X or Y, then hopefully when you come back with the feedback that is, that's just not going to work with our target audience, or we've got to show the product more centrally here, then that will work. Again, I think the thing I learned when I got to BBH actually is that because I'd much junior level, but because I'd played some relatively serious sport at a younger level, I understood that feedback wasn't personal. I understood that, you know, you played the game and then on a Monday you reviewed and you got feedback to make the individual and the team better. So I never, when I was getting feedback from senior people at BBH, fell into a crumpled mess because I knew they were trying to make me better. And that was a thing I took through in my career, actually. If you were working, particularly with a very ambitious individual, one of the things I'd often say is, right, there's a deal we're going to do here, which is I am going to give you tons of feedback. I'm going to give you feedback all the time. I'm not going to save it up for the annual appraisal. I'm going to give it to you after meetings, after pitches, after projects. And the two-way deal is you're going to take it constructively, because what we're going to do is we're going to make you better. And if you can make that connection in people's minds, feedback is going to make them better, serve their career, accelerate their career, then you're away to the races.
And did you work at BBH in the time when Tony Kaye was still operating?
The director?
The film director. Yeah, absolutely. I did a documentary with him. So he famously did the BA ads and the... Did he direct the Dunlop ads or that someone else? Anyway, he was very eccentric, would leave taxis. Will, I don't know if you know who we're talking about, but he was a very famous ad director and went on to film with Ed Norton, didn't he? And he took his name off the film. He went to Hollywood.
American History X.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And right. I was running, doing a series on advertising for the BBC at the time. And that was when it was his kind of peak Tony Kaye. And he would leave taxis running outside shoots and just leave the meter going and then like go away and go, you know, just leave the shoot. Or he'd leave a camera fixed, wouldn't he, on a chair.
Yeah.
And keep the camera. And this is the days of film when, you know, film was ticking over. And he was sort of indulged at that point. And that's what my question's leading up to. And Will, this is a question for you and teams as well. When you have a star player, when you have someone whose talent is so mercurial, so brilliant, and the client, or the client being the audience or the fans, or want to see that player on the pitch, people would like to see Tony Kaye. Clients would like to say they were hiring Tony Kaye. How do you manage extreme talent that is difficult on the pitch? Either of you can answer that question first.
Yeah, team dynamics are absolutely critical. And one of the stories that has been reasonably well acknowledged is spending some time with the Royal Marines down in Limpston. And at the end of, this was when Clive Woodward's England were slumming it at sort of number four or five in the world, whilst being desperate to get to number one in the world. And we started to make some progress, but we got some pretty stark feedback from a very senior member of the Royal Marines saying, I wouldn't go to war with six of your players. Now, this was delivered privately to Sir Clive. And as you would expect, those... Clive looked down in horror, realising they were his best players. What do I do? I mean, I sort of need these players. And it was an understanding from him that we learned that actually then it was really critical to allow and create for parameters, which we didn't have prior to that, to create boundaries, to create a charter, to create a code of conduct, to create a sort of social etiquette. A variety of different organisations use different titles for this, but we called it a code of conduct. And I think all organisations, all teams benefit from this hugely. That if you go away and sit down and understand what makes people tick, what the potholes are, what the buttons you don't press with certain people, what the signals are to understand that people are getting close to the edge where wheels may go off in different directions. then you allow the teams to spot those signals ahead and to self-police, and all the great teams are self-policing. Once you create those sorts of parameters and people feel listened to, and it's the power of your listening on the other side of it to really sit intently and understand about different people that you have in your team, then often it's not about falling into line. It's about them being comfortable to be true to themselves. And I forget the quote that there's often talked about, which is, you know, every child can be taught. You just have to find a way to teach them. But if as long as they have that context and those parameters within which they're the sort of non-negotiables, and as long as they stick to those, then they can express themselves and be the maverick, I think the word is they're often called, that they love to be.
Two little builds on that. The first is, so I think you've named the most famous diva in the, you know, advertising direction world. Tony Kaye was famous for that. But I think there were creative people in agencies who modelled themselves on that very intransigent, I'm the creative auteur and, you know, I won't take feedback, I won't take bills. My honest belief, and there are the odd exceptions, the most talented people I ever worked with, the John Hegartys, the Nick Gills, the Jonathan Glaziers, the Ring and Ledridges, they took feedback. If it was a good idea, they didn't care if it came from the DOP, the client, the account man. If it was a good idea, they were going to take it. John Hegarty was a great example of that. He was very fixed in his opinion and his vision of what he wanted to see. But if it was a great idea that made it better, he'd listen to it. And one final point, we interviewed Dan Carter for the book, the famous Kiwi 10. And he tells a great story about Steve Hansen, who was his coach. And he would say, after an All Black game, Hansen would often pick out Richie McCaw and Dan as the most senior, the most capped, and would give the two of them the toughest feedback in front of everybody. And he would say, and often it felt a bit rough because there are people who played much worse than us, but we knew what he was doing. He was saying to the whole squad, no one's above feedback, 100 caps or 5 caps.
You used the military analogy there, Will, and the experience you had with the armed forces and the parallels you can draw between leadership and teamship. And you quote Colin Powell, who passed away yesterday, the highest position in the US Armed Forces. He had as chief of staff, I believe. And he was talking about data and using data to feedback or measure performance. And you quote him in the book, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said 40% of information is enough and 70% is too late when making decisions. How has data changed your businesses and sport and business since you started in the early 90s?
Clive, actually, we borrowed, I think it was Aston Villa who were the first to use an organisation called Prozone. And Prozone would sort of take a digital imprint of your face as you ran out onto the pitch at Villa Park, and apologies if it wasn't Villa. And that would then track you. And then at the end of the day, you could work out that you'd run 11.4 kilometres at an average speed of X. You'd been stood still for, you'd impersonated a statue on the right wing. I think this is when David Ginola might have been playing,
yes,
for about 27 minutes. Or you worked out that they're all actually working perfectly well, but some positions are just, why are we all doing the same training? And so it absolutely categorically changed the way we trained under a guy called Dave Redd in Otis, as we called him, who went on to work with Gareth Southgate and Clive at the British Olympic Association, to understand our, again, going back to get the heart, get the player, about treating each player as an individual and creating bespoke training that was relevant to them. So again, polishing their super strengths as opposed to assimilating everyone and assuming we're all rugby players, we all do exactly the same thing. So, and in the time when we struggled to beat the very, very, very best team, which were New Zealand, Australia and South Africa, we realised we just weren't physically capable of it.
Yeah.
And so through data over the course of 3 years, I'm pretty proud to say And again, there was no competition. We didn't go to the Olympics for it, but I'm pretty proud to say we turned ourselves into the fittest team in the world the whole team, either super strong in the props or lightning fast in the wings or combinations of that in between numbers 1 and 15. So data and sports science and the aggregation of marginal gains is super, super strong. And the phrase we always use, if you did 100 things 1% better, you'd be world champions.
I remember I stopped playing rugby, I think, when you were starting your ascent. And it just used to be the backs and the forwards. The backs would train over there and the forwards would train over there.
Well, but they'd all do the same business. Yeah. And they'd all go, we'd all go on a 3K run. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure we'd never do a 3K run.
Yeah. And then maybe sprint at the end.
Yeah. Why don't the forwards do shorter stuff? Yeah. Right in the back. Brilliant idea.
Yeah, brilliant. And Ben, in data, and I mean, I see how that works physically and performance-wise with metrics, but do you think that data has bled into business and in particular creative businesses and service industries like advertising in a way which has improved creativity? Because I can see how fitness and efficiency is improved, but is creativity improved by more data? I mean, would of the days of the auteur and the director and the real creative spark in advertising gone?
So I would draw a distinction between the way lots of business operate, which is they develop strategy, they execute, then they measure, and they essentially use data at the end of a given process to review and see how they performed, versus the more enlightened businesses who I believe use insightful, helpful data as a springboard for strategy and for creativity. So they're making sure that data is embedded in the development of their strategy, not a rear view mirror to measure what they've done. So if you worked, for example, if you worked with a brilliant media agency, they would often give you unbelievable targeting data about who to get to, when to get to them, how to get to them. The best planners and strategists I ever worked with were always using data to help make the brief that they gave the creative people better. So I never had much sympathy for data is diminishing creativity. I think if used properly, data is a springboard for more precise, more brilliant creativity. Now, of course, I would struggle with the argument that the algorithm should write the ads. And we've all probably experienced people with way too much data and actually no insight whatsoever. So one has to be cognizant of those two things. But data up the front to make your creativity more precise, to make your strategy more robust, I think can only make businesses like advertising more effective.
And the really clever people get to use the data in such a way that when Johnny Wilkinson stood still doing conversions at the fire in the field and 80,000 people are watching Johnny and all the TV cameras are watching Johnny, some big-nosed larrikin at the far end of the field doing shuttles and came out each week with most distance covered. It took Clive 3 years to realise that I was held up as a paragon of virtue, of elite training and performance.
You're essentially cheating the system.
Hashtag beat the game. Don't use the word cheat, then. It's an inappropriate word. Hashtag beat the game.
Gary Neville said of his experience of being managed by Alex Ferguson, and you talk about this in the book, and there's quite a few examples based around Alex Ferguson and that, the golden squad of, the 92 squad at Man United and how that changed the face of football. Gary Neville said, you could leave Alex Ferguson's office with a smile on your face even after being dropped. I'm finding it very hard to imagine leaving his office with a smile on your face, but that's the public perception. What's the best way to deliver bad news to an individual member of a team, in your experience, both under leaders and as leaders, without causing them to lose confidence in themselves?
Where you just tough on the person and don't address any positive outlook and work-ons and covert, underhand, talk behind. I mean, look, there's a thousand ways you can do it badly. Yeah. The reality is the great leaders who do it well tackle issues head on with the player and discuss the current narrative of the team, current makeup of the team, and how to get back into the team and offer a signpost how to work your way back in, I think would be the best way. The worst one, just write it up on a board and let you fill in the blanks.
Or read about it in the press.
Yeah.
Signpost is a really big idea. It's a big, you know, Will, we've got a difficult conversation to have. I don't want to have it here. I want you to meet me in half an hour and we're going to go for a walk because it's going to be quite awkward for, it's going to be awkward for me to deliver it. I've got to be honest with you. I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable about it, but it might be quite awkward for you to hear. So I want you to have the time to.
Are you role playing now, or are you actually telling her? Okay. I thought I just intruded on something. Sorry. No. You're very good at it.
That kind of signaling.
Just try and send him a duff edit.
I get that message. Yeah.
That kind of signaling helps both of you. I used to do a lot of my toughest conversations on a walk. There's something interesting about when two human beings are not staring at each other. Anyone with teenage kids will know you often have your best conversations in the car when you're not staring at each other.
Your only conversations, actually.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But signalling, I think, is massively important. And again, we hear that often. This is going to be a difficult conversation, but we're going to go for it. We're going to get it all out there. And again, back to context, which Will talked about right at the beginning. So, you know, I'm really sorry to tell you this, Richard, but for the good of the team, you're going to need to miss this one. Now, I've got a game for you in 2 weeks' time where you're going to be perfect. But this next one, we're playing Will. And that is the right thing for the team. And I know you'll understand that and get over it. You'll be disappointed. Of course you will. But I need you fresh for 2 weeks' time. It can be done. And those people, some of the people that we were so blessed to talk to were masters at this. Absolute masters at setting that kind of context.
It seems to have got better, doesn't it, in professional sport when you see squads now for your Premier League teams and your international teams, and you do see the players reacting, especially the England squad. I noticed in the last World Cup, they saw themselves, or at least they gave the perception of seeing themselves as a team. You know,
yeah, I'm looking. I think Eddie Jones did something really, one of the most fabulous pieces of leadership I've seen for a while. Was when he announced the team for the semi-final of the World Cup. And he started in reverse order and named what we would often call the subs, the bench, and he had called the finishers.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to name these guys first because we know the game against All Blacks will be won between minutes 60 and 80.
Yeah.
So I'm going to check and announce those players first because they will be on the field at this stage of time. So that it doesn't always fit that story. It doesn't always fit quite so neatly. But the making it much more about the whole rather than a smaller group of individuals. And I was fortunate enough that post that Marines conversation about six people I won't go to war with, post our real work on our collective code of conduct and our standards of behaviour with each other and the application of the buddy system that was brought in, that when the team for our final was announced, the first people up on their feet after the coach had left were those not in the team to say, look, what can we do for you in the next 72, 96 hours to make sure you win this for us? So creating that collective spirit that is so clear and apparent in a team like Harlequins, for example, in the rugby world at the moment is very doable. It's not a magic wand. You can't just make it happen overnight. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort, a lot of buy-in from players and coaches to go in with much more of an open mind. But it's so much more rewarding winning together. And I think, look, it's something that Alan Jope talked about. If you like winning together, these sorts of characteristics and behaviours are critical.
Yeah, I really miss it from a rugby point of view. Do you both miss? I know you're still very active in terms of working with clients and people, but there's nothing like that feeling at the beginning of your careers, the middle of careers, where you've got a team and it's you against the world, literally. Is there? How do you find, as in terms of, as you're in the sort of second half of your career,
Yeah.
How do you reignite that? Because you've started again at the Growth House, haven't you, Ben? How do you keep that spark of comradeship and excitement?
I got some fabulous advice when I left BBH. So I left BBH in 2018 and I was, you know, I'd led a 450 person company for, you know, 12 years. And I got great advice about the things I was going to find difficult in a startup. Mm. You know, one of them, which was quite funny, was, are you used to people returning your calls?
Yeah.
You were Ben Fennell, CEO of BBH. I had a bit of that. Secondly, you were used to having incoming, you know, a fair bit of your job was reactive, not just proactive. And the third one was you've probably forgotten how much of you has become connected to that role. And you're about to lose that title and that role. The bit that no one warned me about, which was the bit I found hardest, was not being in a team. Because to start with, I was a sole trader. One of the great things about a business growing is you build a team and you build strong relationships with clients. So 3 years in, I'm much, much closer to those terribly important things. But that was the thing I found hardest, being very, very team oriented throughout my life and career. I found that the hardest bit of the transition. And that's one of the many reasons that growth matters so much, because if you're growing, you can hire people and you can build client relationships and you can do that tribal collective thing that human beings since the dawn of time have wanted to do, which is mainly live and congregate and share and be together.
Our metaphorical shake that we drink from every day is to explore mental health, personal mental health each day and work on that, to definitely practice your physical health on each and every day, and make sure you get an element of teamship into every single 24 hours that you pack in. So physical health, mental health and teamship are sort of our three building blocks that both Ben and I really like to focus on.
And if you skip one, you feel it. I mean, that's one of the, well, you know, there's a whole chapter on well-being. It's such a hot topic at the moment. One of the things people often forget about well-being is it's an active pursuit. You've got to do stuff to improve your mental health. It often surprises me that people are eating badly, sleeping badly, not taking any exercise, and then they're surprised their mental health is bad.
Yeah, it doesn't come to you, does it? Well-being doesn't come to you.
Absolutely right.
Interesting. So it's that sort of resilience that you've built up over your careers. It's really fascinating when people who are, you know, have a successful career and teams and build up around them, when they go it alone or go into a different environment, are surprised by the things that you described there, Ben. Because I had the same thing when I left Turner Broadcasting, 200 staff, dinner parties. What do you do? Oh, I'm ahead of this. I'm ahead of that. You know, and then suddenly you're trying to describe what you do, and you can see people glazing over when they just wanted to, you know, they just wanted to position you immediately.
And interestingly enough, I think that's one of the points that when Ben and I chat before we speak publicly about the book or go on and are fortunate enough to be invited on podcasts. I think when you talk about that sort of little smorgasbord, that little portfolio of ideas that you got flying around, that's actually how we'd really like this book to be used, in a way that you might be working on something individually or collectively, team, and a topic might come up. And almost, I had the first photo through from a friend recently with loads of little post-it notes in the book that he could go back to, that he could understand. I'm just feeling that there's pressure on at work at the moment. I'm struggling to understand how to get to talk about feedback. How do I look after my own well-being? How can I be generous to those around me? And sort of really, there are 15 within the difference, togetherness and growth. Each one of those has five really strong topics and loads of different ideas to perhaps get the grey cells thinking of how you might take them, adopt them, tweak them, make them your own. But that's, in a utopian world, that's how we envisage our book to be used. People who are going through a process of change, process of flux, a bit of discombobulation, or looking to go from, you know, from MD level to C-suite level, then that will be our greatest joy, to see it having an impact there.
You humanize each insight as well, and with your examples. And that's the brilliance of, that's the brilliant thing about the technology of the book. People will have a very personal experience in reading it, but they will share your experiences of being candid about the fact that even when people have stellar careers, like when you were injured at Leicester, 1999, dealing with 2 years of injury, you must have felt isolated, judged, you know, alone. You describe how it made you feel, and I think people will relate to that as a as part of a journey, you know, or part of their career. You're not, careers aren't just a linear growth pattern, are they? They kind of zigzag around and
very quickly. I know, because Ben will be really strong on this. One of the nicest things I had was my dad, who was an ex-England captain and an England coach that survived 2.5 years before in the sort of merry-go-round of the late 80s, early 90s of England rugby, perhaps mid to late 80s, before Jack Rowell and then Clive Woodward took over. He said, I wish you'd written this 40 years ago. I might still be in a job. He was literally trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah,
every day, rewrite the coaching manual every single day, and tools like this weren't available. So, you know, for someone who's really close to their dad, and for someone who admires their dad in such a way that I do, for him to say, and he, by the way, he is radically candid about when I'm rubbish. I need to be critically clear on that point.
Yeah, well, I think my dad was a bit like that, a Yorkshire rugby player. And is your dad from Yorkshire?
We were very well. You're in the same cathedral, slightly different choir. We're from the north.
Yeah, the north. Yes. But yeah, I loved your graph. There's some, you know, your don't dwell on it curve. I love that curve, which goes up and then ends with just crack on.
Yeah.
Stop. You know, look back, reflect, but then just crack on.
Think that the human brain, though, I think we know this. The reason setbacks are so important in our development is, you know, and we've written, there's a whole chapter on setbacks. It's one of my favorite chapters, actually, is there is nothing that burns learning into the brain quite as vividly as the hurt of a real setback. And again, parenting, you know this all the time. You can tell your kids 100 times X or Y, but until they've felt that pain, losing a game you had to win, messing up something important at work, that is the most fierce way a human being can learn. And it's why setbacks and growth are so causally related. We can't protect ourselves in a career from setbacks. We can't protect our kids from setbacks. You just got to hope that you find the learning and you pick up and you move forward.
So looking ahead, what do you both have left to learn, and what would you like to win?
Oh my gosh, so much. So I sort of talked about, I toyed, although HSBC wouldn't be happy to hear that I was toying with my career in the early 90s, but I toyed with the finance world for two and a half years, which set me up great. I then went into the rugby, and I've been involved in professional sport for a long, long time, be it either playing or broadcasting. But I've embarked on a new career in AI at a fabulous company called Affinity. And I'm just sitting on calls, loving being part of a new team with slightly different goals, slightly different parameters, but trying to be the best in the world at what we do. So in terms of where I am, I'm sort of setting out on my commercial career the day before my 49th birthday. People tend to go the other way around. So hugely excited to be able to lean on some of the things I've picked up from my professional sporting career over the 20 years, but know that all it does is gets me a foot in the door. The rest is I'll have to work on extremely hard day in, day out to be welcomed to a slightly higher table.
Ben? Yeah, and for me, you know, I was at BBH for 24 years, and I'm just coming to the end of year three of the Growth House. So I'm at the end of the beginning of this chapter, if that makes sense. And I think it's taken 3 years to really understand what I want the business to be. One of the many reasons writing the book was such a fantastic experience, and collaborating with Will the way we did was so fantastic, is it forces you to crunch and to crystallize. You know, it's not strategy till it's written down. and the hours and hours and weeks of figuring out what do we believe on that topic, or what do we think on that, or let's go and speak to someone brilliant about creating a purpose, or what good and bad teamship looks like. And so it's been a really nice kind of symbiotic process for the business, because in writing you clarify your own IP, and again, without sounding too evangelical, I think we've got a message or a set of messages and ideas that we think will not just make businesses and teams and leaders grow faster, we think we'll make them kinder, and we think we'll make them more connected and more vulnerable, and maybe even they might even do a better job at home as well as work, and not think that one or the other has to compromise. So I really hope this is a book that, as Will said, people find useful, but they maybe come back to. You know, I'm starting a new job, so I might go and reread that chapter. So I hope it's a thing that kind of endures and doesn't feel, you know, that was 2021 and it's aged, because it's been wonderful to connect with some of these amazing people, and not least to sort of to work with Will to crunch our IP together.
Will Greenwood and Ben Fennell, thank you very much for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Richard, thanks so much for having us on. It's been an absolute joy.
No, it really has. And we both spend a lot of our time interviewing people. So it's you've made that feel and seem effortless. So thanks very much, Richard.
Will and Ben's book, World Class, How to Lead, Learn and Grow Like a Champion, can be purchased from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. Just follow the link in the episode description. If you'd like to grow with Bookomi a bit more, please like and subscribe to the Bookomi cast on Apple, Spotify or Google or Amazon or anywhere. And follow us at Bookomi on Twitter or Instagram. There's even a Facebook page if you're that way inclined. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay learning, stay lucky and read like a leader. Bye for now.
No one's above feedback, 100 caps or 5 caps.